Hello and welcome to this digital class, Physical Chemistry of Polymers, which is one out of two parts of the module Introduction to Macromolecular Chemistry taught at the Johannes Gutenberg University of Mainz. The other part of this module is an Organic Chemistry of Polymers class, and you are listening to the Physical Chemistry part of this class now. My name is Sebastian Seifert, and I'm a representative of that very field at Johannes Gutenberg University of Mainz. That means my research and teaching focus is on physical chemistry of polymers. Before I forget, if you want to get in touch with me, you can do this most effectively and easily, I would say, via email. Just send an email addressed to the target address sebastian.seifert with double F at uni-mainz.de. The first goal of this first digital lesson is to discuss some mostly technical details on the lecture content, format, and let's say terms and conditions, and then to get started with the actual lecture stuff. So, some technical notes first. The format of this class in the form you're currently listening to is brand new. So far, this class, like most other classes at the place of Mainz and other places in Germany, has been taught in the classical lecture hall setting. That means a group of students, mostly around 20-ish, and the lecturer, meaning me, assembled in the lecture hall once a week, and we had a classical, mostly frontal lecturing style lesson that was also spiced with some here and there active interaction between the lecturer and the student group. In the summer term of 2020, however, we have to use a different format, and the reason for that is a small, nasty, vicious, nanoscopic object named SARS coronavirus 2. And the reason why this small, nanoscopic object forces us to use a totally different lecture format this semester is because it can cause a quite dangerous disease named COVID-19. And as a precaution, we all need to keep some distance from each other, at least 2 meters mutually. And that has made politicians and university presidents to come to the decision to let the summer term of 2020 take place mostly in digital format. And that's the reason why this lecture is given to you in this digital form. For me, it's the first time doing this, and I hereby foresee already that there is a high likelihood of many mistakes to occur during this first trial of a digital lecture, which I hereby already kindly ask you to excuse. Maybe it's also the first time for you to consume a digital lecture, and so it's a precedence for all of us, you as the students and me as the lecturer. But maybe in just one semester down the road, in the winter term of 2020-2021, it may already be normal for us to do such teaching and learning, because we realize these days, as a consequence of the coronavirus pandemic, that things can get quite some momentum, unknowingly and unexpectedly. We all remember the first days of this really severe outbreak of the coronavirus in Germany, where 1 week later things were already impossible that were totally normal just 1 week earlier. But also the other way around, suddenly things were possible that before seemed to be impossible. And maybe digital learning and teaching is experiencing the same, in a sense that digital learning and teaching was quite unpresent in the academic business so far, and all of a sudden the coronavirus pandemic forced us all to engage in such concepts. And perhaps we realize afterwards that this is actually not at all that hard as we estimated it to be. And so maybe these digital learning and teaching formats will find their way into the regular curriculum in the future. What you are listening to is one out of two media with which this lecture content will be broadcasted to you, an audio podcast. This is accompanied by a written PDF copy lecture script that you can download on the website of my research group at University Mainz, which is reachable via the short domain www.seifert-group.de. And on that page, you will find a section named Teaching, and within that section, you will find a subsection named Physical Chemistry of Polymers 1. And there you have yet another subsection entitled Scripts, and in that section, you can find a PDF copy of the script. And on the very main page, you will find the audio podcasts, the first one of which you are listening to right now. So apparently, you have successfully localized it. The script will come to you as a series of PDF files, one for each lesson. And in these PDFs, each lesson unit of the lecture is noted down in sort of a headline type format. So bullet points, just like the ones you would note down by hand when taking handwritten notes during a classical lecture hall class. These short PDF scripts are actually excerpted from a larger textual basis for this lecture. And this is the textbook Physical Chemistry of Polymers, A Conceptual Introduction, published by the De Gruyter publisher just in spring of 2020. The ISBN number of this book is 978-311-0672800. With that number, you can locate it somewhere, or maybe just entering the title into a search engine of your choice. Physical Chemistry of Polymers, A Conceptual Introduction, De Gruyter Publishing, 2020, will help you localizing this book. This textbook lays down to you even further content and deeper details as the ones discussed in this lecture. And the PDF scripts that are made available to you on the lecture website are short-term synopses taken from this book. Along with a lecture, there is also an exercise that also takes place in a digital form in the summer term of 2020. The way of how this exercise works is that every other week, an exercise sheet will be made available to you for download also on the lecture website. You can download it and solve the exercises or questions on that sheet individually by yourself. They should all be doable just with pen and paper. And then you can scan your solutions or just take a photograph of them and send these to Marta Kotziol, who is a PhD student in my research group, and will check your solutions to the exercise and give you individual feedback. You can reach her via email addressed to the target address mkotziol01@uni-mainz.de. One last technical question that is certainly on all of your minds is, what about the exam? Classically, so far, the exam took place in the last week of the semester. It consists of both a physical chemistry part and an organic chemistry part, both designated to take 60 minutes to solve. So in total, you had 120 minutes solving these two parts of the common exam. The physical chemistry part of the exam was always given out in two languages, in the English language and in the German language, both covering the same content. And you were free to pick either language to solve the questions. Most of the questions were mathematically anyways, so they don't even have a language apart from the language of mathematics. And for those questions where wording answers were required, it was totally fine if you reply to these in the English or the German language. Also, mixtures of these languages were fine to us so far. I don't have yet any clue what we have to expect for the summer term of 2020, in what form exams can and will take place. And for the moment, I can just ask you for patience on that question, and information on that will, of course, reach you in due course. One maybe last technical announcement. Some of you may wonder already why I'm talking to you in English language. This is because the lecture language of the physical chemistry part of this class is English. This may appear to be some kind of challenge to many of you, which I think is good, because challenges actually make you grow. So therefore, I encourage you to consider this not only as a great challenge, which it certainly is, but also as a great chance. This way, you will not only have the chance to learn about physical chemistry of polymers, but also to get some notion of a key qualification that you will need for your later profession, which will be some sort of leading position in most likely both an international and interdisciplinary environment. Okay, after having detailed on these terms and conditions, I would like to discuss the more fundamental and interesting questions, which is the what and why of this lecture. You know that chemistry can be categorized into several fields. The most famous ones in general and also known to you from your previous studies are inorganic chemistry, organic chemistry, and physical chemistry. There is also lots of other fields into which chemistry can be further subsectioned, such as analytical chemistry, biochemistry, theoretical chemistry, supramolecular chemistry, and so on. The order of naming these subfields that I have just used is according to their historical emergence. Analytical chemistry is actually quite established already. Biochemistry is somewhat newer. Theoretical chemistry is also somewhat newer. Supramolecular chemistry, to me, is the newest subfield of chemistry. It traces back to a Nobel Prize that was awarded not even 50 years ago. And in this context, certainly a further field must be named in this row, and this is macromolecular chemistry. Macromolecular chemistry is a field that is exactly 100 years old now at the time of recording of this audio podcast, as it traces back to the year 1920 when Hermann Staudinger, we will get to this name again at the end of this class, published his paper entitled Überpolymerisation, which was the groundstone of the whole field of polymer or macromolecular chemistry. And if there wouldn't have been a coronavirus pandemic, I think certainly the 100-year jubilee of that historical moment would have been a great event in this year for the chemistry community. It actually still is a great event for the chemistry community. Unfortunately, it's somehow overshadowed by the coronavirus pandemic at this time. In a classical lecture hall setting, at this point, I usually pose a question to the students, and the question is, where in your lives did you come across polymers already? Maybe even today. And after some time of thinking, there is some shout-ins from the audience, such as in shoe soles, or in plastic bags, or in furniture, or in smartphone cases. If we collect this list a little more, we can get to the conclusions that polymers are everywhere, also in lives. Life forms actually are well based on polymers. There is a saying by the German scientist Bruno Vollmert, who wrote an historical seminal textbook on polymer science, that polymers are actually nothing less than the highest level of complexity in chemistry and the lowest level of complexity in biology. But why are polymers so relevant, both for the biological and for the material science? Well, I would say because they exhibit a very wide range of properties that are tunable on the basis of the primary molecular structure. So polymers are a stereotype example of a class of materials whose properties are versatile and rationally understandable by structure property relations. And this is what this lecture is targeted at. In physical chemistry of polymers, we aim to achieve an understanding of the relations between structure and properties of polymers, which means to connect molecular parameters to macroscopic behavior. The advantage of doing this is because once we have such understanding, we can do the opposite, and this means we can do rational design of polymer materials. This connection actually bridges the fields of polymer chemistry and polymer engineering. This is illustrated in figure one in our script. In this figure, you see a continent on the left-hand side. This is polymer chemistry, and another continent on the right-hand side. This is polymer engineering, and these two continents are separated from each other by a water body. And there is a bridge that arcs between these two continents, and this bridge is physical chemistry of polymers. And this bridge rests on three pillars. These three pillars are single-chain statistics, multi-chain interactions, and chain dynamics. All these three will be in the scope of this present lecture. And if we stay in this picture, this means that what this bridge does to us is it bridges chemical structures to macroscopic engineering properties. And this means we can walk this bridge in either direction. We can understand from what primary chemical structure a certain beneficial property originates from. And also reversely, we can say that if we want to engineer a material that has these and those properties, it must have this and that structure. This is a structure property relation given to us by physical chemistry of polymers. And this is actually what you will do in your later profession if you find yourselves being a laboratory leader at a large chemical company. Customers usually are not interested in a chemical structure. What they are interested in is a function. And as developing chemists, what you must do is to translate this desired function into measurable physical parameters and then go ahead and translate these parameters into a primary structure. In the field of physical chemistry of polymers, these structure property relations often turn out to be scaling laws, meaning we have connections between quantities of interest that follow the form of a mathematical power law. One of the most fundamental power law dependencies that we will come across in this lecture is the power law scaling of the size of a polymer coil, which is given by its squared radius, and the number and lengths of segments that constitute it. The scaling law reads R square is equal to C infinity times N times L square. R square is the mean square radius of a polymer coil. C infinity is a quantity that we will get to know in more detail. It's named the characteristic ratio. N is the number of segments in our chain, and L is the segmental length. And whereas the parameter C infinity characteristic ratio is specific to each specific polymer, the part of the equation with NL square is universal and applies to all polymers. So we see that the chemical specificity is captured by the parameter C infinity, whereas physical universality is captured in the scaling N times L square. So what we also see in this context is that there is some universality and some specificity in polymers. There are some properties that can be traced back to the specific chain chemistry, and there is universal properties that have to do with universal polymer physics. Another example is a phenomenon named glass transition. This is a phenomenon that is shown by all polymer materials. When we cool down a polymer melt at some point, there will be a freeze-in of dynamics of motion in this system. And that means although the structure is still amorphous, there is no longer any dynamics. And such a state that has a non-crystalline but amorphous state without any dynamics is named a glass. A little footnote in this context, why is the glass transition seen for all polymers but not for many low molar mass substances? The reason is the large size and therewith the low mobility of the building blocks in polymer materials. When cooling down a melt of a material at some point, we pass the freezing point, and that's the point where a crystalline structure forms and the solid crystalline state is formed. For polymers, however, this is a process that takes long because the building blocks are not small molecules, but large polymer chains. And so what happens earlier is a freezing in of all dynamics with not yet established crystalline microstructure. This corresponds to a glassy state, a state with amorphous structure and frozen dynamics. Hence, the occurrence of a glass transition is universal and occurs for all polymers. So this is universality laid down by physics. The point and temperature where this happens, however, is specific for each specific polymer. This is because the point where the chain motion freezes in has to do with a local chain mobility. And that in turn has to do with its local specific chemical constitution. And this is specificity nailed down by chemistry. In our lecture, we want to get the basics, the fundament of such relations. And with that, we will erect the bridge of figure one that arcs between polymer chemistry and polymer engineering. We will do so in four chapters. The first chapter is the one you're listening to right now, Introduction. In this chapter, we will delineate the field of macromolecular chemistry and define some terms. The second chapter will be entitled Ideal Polymer Chains. You may recall the starting point into elementary physical chemistry in the earlier semesters of your studies. What you discussed first in physical chemistry after some general introduction and some mathematical background was the most simple state of matter that you can possibly imagine, and that was the ideal gas. We will do the same when approaching polymers and discuss a very simplifying, actually oversimplifying, notion of polymer chains, which is so-called ideal chains. And we will get to know some statistical approaches to describe the structure of such ideal polymer chains. And as we will see, this will already lead us to one of the most fundamental properties of polymers, which is their entropy-based elasticity. Just like in physical chemistry 1, where at some point you realize that the ideal gas model has limitations, and that led you to the real gas model, in chapter number 3 of our class, we will discuss real polymer chains and take into account aspects that we have ignored in the ideal chain recognition, which is interactions within the polymer coils and potential solvents trapped inside of them. In chapter number 4, we will get even one step further and discuss interactions not only within one polymer coil, but also between polymer coils. So there, for the first time, we will actually discuss multi-chain systems in the realm of discussing thermodynamics of polymer systems. With that, we have not yet erected the bridge of figure 1. What we have erected actually is the three pillars on which the bridge can be constructed. To actually erect the bridge on top of these pillars, we need to discuss some more. And as an outlook, I can advertise already the class Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2, which is taught on master studies levels in Mainz, that will erect that very bridge, meaning that will deliver structure property relations to you on top of which the bridge is erected. The most relevant properties of polymers that have most decisively shaped our lives and use of them is their mechanical properties. So this lecture will have a large focus on rheology of polymer systems. And as we want to discover structure property relations, we also need some knowledge on how to determine structures experimentally. And the prime class of techniques usable for that purpose in the context of polymer science is scattering techniques. So this second class, Physical Chemistry of Polymers, actually has two main chapters only. A large chapter on rheology and mechanics of polymer systems, and another not so large but equally important chapter on scattering analysis of polymer systems. Let's get started with some fundamentals. Let's define some terms. In polymer chemistry, we use two terms more or less synonymously, the term macromolecule and the term polymer. I would like to get started with this lecture by delimiting these terms from each other. Let's have a look at figure 2 of our script. Here we see some kinds of chemical, biological, and technical small entities within which macromolecules find themselves more or less in the center. Macromolecules are certainly larger than normal molecules and most certainly larger than atoms, but they are smaller than other objects from other fields, such as the field of biology. They are smaller than biological objects such as viruses, vesicles, and cells. So here we see already once more that macromolecules take a center position between chemistry and biology. Largest level of complexity in chemistry, lowest level of complexity in biology. The term macromolecule is composed of two words, the Greek macro, which means large, and the word molecule in its classical meaning. Little footnote in this context, molecule actually derives from the Latin molecular, which means small mass. So when we take this together, a macromolecule would actually be something with a large small mass, which is kind of a contradiction. But I think we know what is meant with macromolecule. Macromolecules refers to large molecules, and when they are large, they are also heavy, as also denoted in figure 2. With macromolecule, we address molecules with sizes in the range of some tens to hundreds of nanometers and molar masses of some thousands up to millions of grams per moles. Delimited from that is the term polymer. Polymer is also a word composed of two Greek parts. The first part is the word poly, which means many, and the second part is the Greek meros, which means parts. Polymers, therefore, are molecules composed of many parts. They are chain molecules constituted of a sequence of many repeating units. These units are named monomers. In summary, we can say that the term macromolecule refers to any sort of large molecule, whereas the term polymer refers to those large molecules built of a repeating sequence of structural units, the so-called monomer units. That means we can constitute that each polymer is a macromolecule, but not each macromolecule is a polymer. Somewhat questionable in that case are biopolymers, such as proteins and DNA, namely, whereas on the one hand they are built out of certain building blocks, such as nucleotides in the case of DNA, or amino acids in the case of proteins, this is not a stoically repeating sequence of always the same monomer units. But by contrast, proteins display a rich variety of sequences of 20 natural amino acids, and DNA also displays a rich variety of local structures, local sequences of 4 natural nucleotides. This is actually the basis of carrying information and of having highly specific key and lock functions of these molecules. I would like to refrain from this pea-picking discussion as to whether or not these are polymers or not. I would say we can perfectly agree to name them biopolymers, and that's it. In general, when we are uncertain about the adequateness of a term in chemistry, we can always address the gold standard reference, which is IUPAC. This institution has definitions for everything, also for polymers. And according to IUPAC, a polymer is defined as a molecule of high relative molar mass, the structure of which essentially comprises the multiple repetition of units derived, either actually or conceptually, from molecules of low relative molar mass. In many cases, the addition or removal of one or a few of these units has a negligible effect on the molecular properties. This is a definition that actually not only applies to molecular, but also to macroscopic properties, as shown to you in figure 3 of our script. What you see there is the boiling points and melting points. Boiling points are represented by the black data set. Melting points are represented by the blue data set. And you see this of alkanes and polyethylenes with N-methylene units. So all the way on the left on the N-axis are small alkanes such as methane, ethane, propane, butane, and so on. And if we go further to the right, we come to polyethylenes. And what we see that whereas the boiling point sharply increases and at some point stops, because at some point the boiling point then has reached so high temperatures that the molecules decompose rather than boil. In contrast to that, the melting point curve actually reaches a plateau level, which is the melting points of long chain polyethylenes. So for those, it doesn't matter if we add a few more methylene units or remove a few methylene units, the melting point stays more or less the same, which is perfectly in line with the IUPAC definition of a polymer. A striking feature of polymers is that they are highly irregular. This is a consequence of the statistical nature of making polymers. Polymer formation processes and reactions are in the focus of the organic chemistry part of this class. And as you will see throughout this class, is that these processes are all governed by statistics. And as you will see, the outcome of this is a highly pronounced irregularity and non-uniformity of both the chain local structures and lengths. Already along one single chain, there can be structural irregularity if there is multiple ways of monomer-monomer connection, such as head-to-head or head-to-tail or tail-to-tail interconnection, as shown to you in figure 2. On top of that, if there is also different possible stereochemistries of the monomer-monomer connection, referred to as tacticity, we can also have some irregularities such as isotactic, syndiotactic, or atactic polymers or sequences, as shown to you in figure 5 of our script. For multifunctional monomers, such as dienes, there is even more ways of interconnection abilities, as shown to you in figure 6 of our script, that shows to you different possibilities of diene monomer interconnection in the case of the monomer isoprene, which can either be made to 1,4 trans polyisoprene, 1,4 cis polyisoprene, 1,2 polyisoprene, or 3,4 polyisoprene. The two upper ones are also referred to by the common names gutta-percha and natural caoutchouc. We will come to these two substances later in our current lesson. On top of this local structural irregularity along one single chain, there is also pronounced inhomogeneity, that means non-uniformity, of the chain lengths and therewith also the chain masses in an ensemble of multiple chains. This is referred to as polydispersity. Figure number 7 in our script shows a typical molar mass distribution curve in two representations. The large main diagram shows the most typical representation, which denotes the frequency of occurrence on the y-axis of molar masses in the sample denoted on the x-axis. The inset small representation in the upper right corner represents an integral plot of that distribution curve, in a sense that all chains in the sample up to a certain molar mass of interest denoted on the m-axis is plotted in a summary fashion on the y-axis. Such distribution curves can be determined experimentally by separation techniques that separate or fractionate a polydispersed sample into multiple monodispersed fractions, which are then analyzed with suitable molar mass analysis methods, and together that information yields a distribution curve. For practical purposes, it is often sufficient not to work with the entire distribution curve, but only with some characteristic averages in it. These are also denoted by dotted lines in figure number 7. In polymer chemistry, we commonly use one or two out of three characteristic averages, which are named number average molar mass, weight average molar mass, and centrifugal average molar mass, often also referred to as Z average, whereby the Z stands for the German Zentrifugenmittel. The averages can be calculated from the distribution curves on the basis of so-called moments of the distribution function. In mathematics, moments of a distribution curve generally reflect its characteristic properties. The so-called first moment, by and large, has to do with the arithmetic average of the distribution. The second moment has to do with the width of the distribution. And the third moment has to do with the skewness of the distribution. The way how moments are calculated is denoted to you by the handwritten formula in the script. Basically, the feature of interest, in our case the molar mass, is summed up over all of its representatives in the sample, weighted with a weighting factor, which is also named argument, which is here the number, the weight, or the Z-based weighting of the occurrence of certain molar masses in the sample. As said, we in polymer chemistry are primarily interested in the three average values, number average, weight average, and Z average, and those averages are calculated by ratios of the moments of the distribution function. For example, the number average calculates as the ratio of the first and the zeroth moment of the number-based distribution function. The weight average calculates as a ratio of the second and the first moment of the number-based distribution function, and the Z average calculates as a ratio of the third over the second moment of the number-based distribution function. The number and weight average can also be imagined illustratively. What the number average denote is, as its name says, the number weighted averaging over the molar masses in our sample. That means we consider our sample and make ourselves clear that it consists of such and such many chains in total, all of which having different lengths. And the number average length, and thereby also the number average weight, and thereby also the number average molar mass, denotes the average value calculated simply by counting together number fractions. That means such and such many chains in our sample out of a total of such and such have masses so and so, such and such many chains in our sample out of a total of such and such have masses so and so, and such many samples in our sample out of a total of such and such have masses so and so. And then we average over this. The weight average uses the weight fraction as basis. That means we don't count numbers of chains here, but weight fractions, in the sense that we say our sample has a total weight of, let's say, 1 gram, and of this 1 gram, such and such of a weight fraction is constituted by chains that are that and that heavy, such and such weight fraction is constituted by chains that are that and that heavy, and such weight fraction is constituted by chains that are that and that heavy. We can imagine already that the latter average puts more emphasis on the heavy chains in the sample. The heavy guys in the weight average have stronger emphasis than the light guys, whereas in the number average, all of them have the same emphasis. Mathematically, this reflects itself such that in the calculation of the weight average, in the numerator of the ratio, the individual molar masses Mi enter as a square, whereas in the number average, they enter in a linear fashion. The Z-average molar mass puts even more emphasis on the heavy guys, in a sense that in that calculation, the individual fractions Mi in the numerator of the ratio enter with a power of 3. The different molar mass averages can also be determined experimentally. A prime method to determine the number average is the technique of osmometry. What we need to determine a number average is generally an experimental method that probes and quantifies an effect that scales with the number of molecules in a sample. Such effects are known to you from elementary physical chemistry as colligative properties. The three main representatives of these colligative properties are the boiling point elevation, the freezing point depression, and osmotic pressure. Osmotic pressure is the most pronounced effect out of these three, and so polymer science primarily targets at this effect to determine a number average molar mass. We will see how exactly that works in chapter number 4 of our lecture. The weight average molar mass is determined by a different technique, namely static light scattering. We will see how this works and why this technique delivers us a weight average in the second part of this lecture series, Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2. The Z-average, as its alternative name, ultracentrifugal average, already denotes, is determined by the method of ultracentrifugation. To give this some illustrative image, let's consider an example. Let's consider a hypothetic sample that consists of 100 chains in total, 10 of them having a molar mass of 100,000 grams per mole, 50 of them having a molar mass of 200,000 grams per mole, 30 of them having a molar mass of 500,000 grams per mole, and 10 out of them having a molar mass of 1 million grams per mole. If we calculate the number average according to the methods and formulas we have just made ourselves clear, the outcome is a value of 360,000 grams per mole. This value denotes to us that a hypothetic monodisperse sample that consists of 100 uniform chains that all have a molar mass of 360,000 grams per mole would show the same osmometric effects than our polydisperse example sample that we consider at this moment. If we calculate the weight average for this hypothetic sample, the outcome would be a value of 545,000 grams per mole. This value denotes to us that a sample made out of chains that all have this very molar mass, this would be less than 100 chains in that sample, then to ensure that the total sum weight of the chains in this hypothetic monodisperse sample and our original polydisperse sample are the same. And this new hypothetic monodisperse sample would show the same light scattering features than our polydisperse one. By comparison of the values, we see already that the weight average, 545,000 grams per mole, is a lot larger than the number average, 360,000 grams per mole, because the fraction of the heavy samples receives more pronunciation in calculating the weight average than it does in calculating the number average. For the sake of completeness, the z-average molar mass in that example would be 722,000 grams per mole, which is because it pronounces the heavy chains in our polydisperse sample even more than the weight average does. A hypothetic monodisperse sample that would consist of only chains of 722,000 grams per mole in a total number that retains the overall sum mass would show the same centrifugation properties than our original polydisperse sample. The broadness of the molar mass distribution is reflected by a quantity named polydispersity index, often referred to as PDI, and the definition of the PDI is just the weight average divided by the number average. As you will see in the organic chemistry part of this class, typical numbers are 3 to 10 for the case of uncontrolled free radical chain growth polymerization, PDIs somewhere in the range greater than 2 for step growth processes such as polycondensation or polyaddition, and values smaller than 1 for a quite sophisticated approach named quasi-living polymerization. The truly living polymerization, which you also will get to know in the organic chemistry part of this class, such as anionic living polymerization, delivers to you a PDI of 1. This means that in such samples, weight and number average are the same, and that means that the distribution is infinitesimally narrow. The distribution function for chain growth and step growth polymerization is named Schultz-Zim distribution. Equation 1.1 features it. It also has a variant named Schultz-Flory distribution, as reflected by equation 1.2. It denotes the frequency of occurrence of a certain degree of polymerization in our sample in the form of its weight fraction in a sample as a function of the degree of conversion of functional groups in such a process, or alternatively, if we consider a free radical polymerization process, as a function of the probability for a chain growth step to occur relative to the sum of probabilities of any step to occur. You will get to know this in more detail also in the organic chemistry part of this class. This distribution function is delimited from another one, which is named Poisson distribution, and this is this very, very narrow distribution function that you get for living polymerization processes. It's equation 1.3 in our script. And as you see from the following equation, 1.4, this one gives a very narrow distribution with a PDI that approaches 1 with preceding reaction progress. The derivation of the Schultz-Flory distribution is something that is also featured in our script for the sake of keeping this audio podcast conceptual and also living. I would like to not discuss this in detail here. If you're interested in that, you will find that laid down in the script and in even further level of detail in the textbook Physical Chemistry of Polymers. It's equations number 1.5 up to 1.27 in the script and textbook. We already spoke about properties of polymers. What are the most striking properties of polymers? Well, we can say that, first of all, polymers exhibit properties that are quite fundamentally different from the ones of their low molar mass counterparts. And this is due to their ill-defined structure and due to their large size. Table number 1 compiles some examples of properties and compares them for classical low molar mass materials and polymer materials. For example, whereas the composition of classical low molar mass materials is uniform and well-defined, sometimes all the way down to the stereochemistry, the one of polymer materials, as we have just seen, is polydisperse and irregular. The solubility of classical low molar mass materials is also well-defined. There is a dissolution equilibrium that we can calculate that gives us a certain grams per liter or moles per liter concentration up to which a substance of interest dissolves in a medium of interest. This is also somewhat different for polymers. If we want to put it down in a nutshell, there is something like an all-or-nothing behavior for polymers. We will get an understanding about the why of this later on in chapter number 4 of our class. We can already take a glimpse on it by making us clear the following bottom line. In general, mixing of a component A, which can be a solute, and a component B, which can be a solvent, has two contributions, an energetic one and an entropic one. Entropy is always in favor of mixing, because mixing creates disorder. However, entropy does not have such a big pronunciation in polymer systems as compared to low molar mass systems. And this is because in a polymer system, a certain given amount, like 1 gram, contains just few molecules, because these molecules are so large. Whereas in a low molar mass substance, this 1 gram contains a lot of molecules, because they are small and light. And this means that although we create disorder in both cases, the extent of that is a lot less in the polymer system than in the low molar mass system. That means in the polymer system, it really comes down to energy to drive the mixing process. Energy, however, in general, is opposing mixing. Because if you want to mix a component A with a component B, what is happening on a molecular scale? You break interactions of A with A, you break interactions of B with B, and you form newly interactions of A with B. And whatever interactions A undergoes, and whatever interactions B undergoes, be it van der Waals interactions, dipole-dipole interactions, hydrogen bonding, or whatever, it can most likely best do so with its own kind rather than with a different kind. That means, in very general, the interactions between A and B can at most be similar, but never as perfect as the ones between A and A and between B and B. That means energy generally disfavors mixing. Mixing usually happens because entropy drives it, but as we have just seen, entropy doesn't play that big role in polymer systems, and so in polymer systems we really need energy to help us out here. And if it does so, large amounts of polymers will dissolve. If it does not so, however, no amount of polymer will dissolve. And this causes this more or less all or nothing behavior. It's not exactly like that. Strictly speaking, there is also dissolution limits and accompanying concentrations for polymer systems, but we can generally express it as being more or less all or nothing type. Melt behavior is another class of properties featured in Table 1. Low molar mass materials usually form low viscous belts. There are some high viscous examples, such as glycerol, which is for molecules that have very strong mutual interactions. In the glycerol, it's multiple hydrogen bonding interactions. But most low molar mass materials still, or though, have low viscosities. This is different for polymer systems. Polymer systems are usually very highly viscous, or even no longer purely viscous, but viscoelastic. The reason is, again, that polymers are large molecules that need great energies of activation for relaxation and flow, and that causes, as we will see in the second part of this class, high viscosities. On top of that, the long chain molecules can also even mechanically entangle if the chain length is high enough for that, which imparts even further great substantial hindrance on their motion. The result of this is a rich mechanical behavior, from elastic snap or viscous creep and relaxation to viscous flow. And that is actually the prime relevance for which polymers have entered multiple fields in industry and in our lives. And due to that relevance, large portions of an own lecture are devoted to that, namely the large chapter number 5 in our class Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2. Last point entered in table number 1 is purification aspects. For low molar mass materials, you know purification steps such as distillation or crystallization from your organic chemistry laboratory classes. For polymers, this is different. Polymers are hard to crystallize due to their ill-defined primary molecular scale structure. They are also hard, or let's better say impossible, to be distilled due to the non-ability to vaporize them. However, what works very nicely for polymers is the method of precipitation. This actually relies on the all-or-nothing solubility that we have just discussed. When we think about a polymer in a solvent that is a good solvent for the polymer, meaning having favorable energetic interactions, and we then turn this solvent into a bad solvent, for example, tweaking the temperature or adding a huge excess of a non-solvent, what happens is that the polymer, according to its all-or-nothing behavior, turns to the nothing side and precipitates from the solution. Low molar mass impurities, such as residual monomer or catalyst from the polymerization reaction, remain dissolved, because for those low molar mass compounds, entropy is the main mixing force. And that means we actually have a quite easy way of separating polymers from a reaction mixture. Just turn the solvent into a non-solvent by, for example, adding a huge excess of a non-solvent, precipitate the polymer, isolate it by filtration, and then do this 2 or 3 times again. What results is a suitably purified form of the polymer. This discussion has shown to us that polymers have properties that are quite distinct from the ones of low molar mass materials. Why is that? We have already said and seen at some of these examples that a prime reason is the comparably large size of polymer molecules. We can also view this from a more general perspective and make us clear that with that, polymers are a prime example of a class of materials named soft matter. What is soft matter? Soft matter refers to, as the name says, to materials that are soft. The general physical grounds on which that lays is that soft matter is all materials that are composed of large building blocks, meaning building blocks in the colloidal domain that have interaction energies in the range of only some tens of RT at room temperature. Footnote in this context. Do you recall from Physical Chemistry 1 what the value of RT at room temperature is? It's about 2.5 kilojoules per mole. From now on forever, please never forget this value. Why? Because as prospective chemists, you need to argue with energies all the time. When you discuss reaction mechanisms, for example, you discuss what kinds of bonds are broken and what kinds of bonds are newly formed. You discuss the energy cost that you have to spend for breaking the bonds, and you discuss the energy gain that you make by the formation of new bonds. Energies of covalent bonds, such as those you regard in such discussions, are in the range of some hundreds of kilojoules per mole. 300 or 350 or 400 kilojoules per mole is roughly the order of magnitude which carbon-carbon bonds have, for example. The value of RT at room temperature of 2.5 kilojoules per mole now serves as a ruler for this. It's like the steps on a ruler. I can give you an analogy. If I say to you that building over there is 10 meters tall, that information is meaningless to you if you don't know what a meter is. If you don't know what a meter is, you have no clue whether 10 meters is tall or short. If you know what 1 meter is, however, you can judge information such as that building is 10 meters tall. Same is the case for energies. If we take the value of 350 kilojoules per mole that a carbon-carbon bond has, we can now say that this is a lot more than 100 times RT at room temperature. This means this bond is a lot stronger than what we have available thermally. In other words, this bond is closed. We need substantial energy inputs to open it, which can be provided by severe heating or by irradiation with electromagnetic radiation in the UV range. By contrast, interaction energies in biological systems, such as hydrogen bonding interactions, are a lot weaker. They are in the range of just 10 to 20 kilojoules per mole. This is only 5 to 10 times RT at room temperature. And this is an energy which is not substantially higher than what we have as the thermal noise. And this means that whereas these interactions are strong enough to keep things together, they are also weak enough to allow these things to be spread if needed. A prime example is the double-stranded DNA, whose double strands are held together by both hydrogen bonding interactions and pi-pi stacking interactions. And this gives an entity that is connected together in a stable fashion, but that can also be separated and opened again if necessary, which it always is when the DNA shall be read or replicated. Energy scales of that magnitude are very typical for soft matter. Together with a building block size of some tens to hundreds of nanometers, we can actually even estimate physical parameters, such as the elastic modulus. The elastic modulus is a constant of proportionality in Hooke's law, which connects stress and strain of a material specimen that is stretched, and so it is an engineering property that tells us how hard it is to deform a material. Microscopically, this has to do with the cohesive energy density, with the density of energy that holds the building blocks together. The stronger this energy density holds the building blocks together, the harder it is to macroscopically deform the object, and vice versa. The energy density is roughly the interaction energy divided by the volume over which it is operative, which is roughly the size of our object cube. If we calculate that, so if we take the tens to hundreds of RT at room temperature as the energy and the tens to hundreds of nanometers as the size of the object, we come up with energy densities of some thousands to roughly a million newton per square meter. And this is typical values of an elastic modulus of polymeric or colloidal matter. Hard classical matter, by contrast, comes along with stronger interaction energies and with smaller building blocks, which are normal molecules or atoms. And there, the energy density turns out to be in the range of 10 to the 12 newton per square meters. This is roughly the elastic modulus of diamond. A third property of soft matter is that despite its comparably weak interaction energies, it takes comparable long times for the building blocks to migrate and move, which is again due to their large size. The microscopic timescale it takes for the building blocks of a material to switch their positions, which means the time it takes for the building blocks to migrate a distance as far as their own size is referred to as relaxation time. We will get to this quantity in a lot more detail in the second part of our class. For polymeric and other colloidal materials, these relaxation times, due to the large size of the objects, are in the range of some milliseconds to seconds, sometimes even minutes or hours. This is ranges which are of actual practical relevance. This is the everyday timescale that we operate with in applications. And that means that these materials show a rich viscoelasticity depending on the timescale of observation and, by the way, on temperature, as we will also see in greater detail in part 2 of our class. On some timescales, the materials more display viscous behavior. On other timescales, the materials more display elastic behavior. This is what we refer to as viscoelasticity. Polymers are a prime representative of such soft matter. The shape of a polymer chain, as we will see in our next lesson unit, is that of a random coil with a couple of 10 nanometers in diameter. This is right in this colloidal soft matter domain. The relaxation times of polymers are in the range of milliseconds to seconds, and the chain-chain interaction is mostly via van der Waals interactions with interaction energies right in the domain of about 10 RT. This means that polymers are a prime representative of soft matter, and that means, in addition to the large and relevant practical properties they have, they are also of very fundamental physical interest. Because studying polymers is easy, as they are large and slow. And so it's possible to observe them, and to observe, for example, phase transitions and ordering phenomena with optical microscopy. The insights that we gain from that are transferable also to classical material, because the basic physics is the same. It's just slower and larger for polymers. This very insight has brought the French physicist Pierre-Gilles Degen the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1991. And Degen was it who framed the term soft matter and introduced polymers to be a prime representative of that. Let's have a little look on the history of polymer science. We have touched it already here and there in the previous discussion, but let's regard this a little more systematically. Polymers actually have been in use by humanity ever since. There is reports that are millennia old about the use of materials such as cotton or silk or bitumen in Mexico, China, and the Orient. That means for centuries and millennia, people have actually extracted polymer-based matter from natural resources and made use out of them. With the discovery of North America by Columbus, further materials such as rubber and gutta percha, remember that was the cis and trans 1,4 polyisoprene that we have touched upon already earlier in this class, were discovered and became useful. Rubber is a material that we well know that is used everywhere in our world. The prime example is in car tires. It is gained from natural caoutchouc, which upon treatment with sulfur turns into a rubbery polymer network, and that is what gives rubber. Gutta percha is a variant of that. The name derives from the Malayic gutta, which means rubber, and percha, which means tree, so it's derived from the Malayic rubber tree. It's a dried latex of that very plant. It's harder than caoutchouc at room temperature, but softens at 50 degrees Celsius, and it turned out to be a very excellent isolating material and was used to wrap transcontinental underwater telephone cables in pre-satellite communication times. A little anecdotal but also somehow worrisome footnote in that context, underwater cables for telephone connection were replaced later on by satellite communication, but quite recently a re-emergence of that technique has been witnessed when the stock exchange of London and New York were connected by an underwater cable laid along a geopleat line to be as short as possible with the intent to make trading faster by 6 milliseconds. Apparently, our economy has reached a state where even 6 milliseconds of further acceleration make enough profit to make this worth doing. I actually have a hard time finding that inspiring. The onset of industrial polymer science was when Charles Goodyear came across the ability to gain rubber by sulfuric treatment of natural caoutchouc. This is a special milestone in the historical development of polymer science because it is the first industrial scale, that means mass scale modification of a natural polymer material, and therefore signifies the advent of a new chemical industry in this field. There is a famous anecdote about the discovery of that by Goodyear. According to that, this was actually discovered accidentally. Goodyear founded a company to produce waterproof rubbery articles in Roxbury, Massachusetts, United States. But this caoutchouc turned out to be a soft glue substance when heated, whereas it was brittle in the cold. Goodyear, who was training himself in chemistry, however, turned out to be persistent in searching for a method, and he tried various approaches to achieve that, none of which successful. In 1839, however, by accident, he dropped a sulfuric caoutchouc mixture to a hot plate, and the result was a dry and durably elastic substance. As we know today, the chemical basis behind this is three-dimensional cross-linking, that means network formation, of the caoutchouc chains by sulfur bridges. As a tragic footnote in this context, Goodyear was not at all successful as a businessman. Despite the great commercial success that his method later on had, for example, in automotive industry for car tire production, Goodyear was poor all along his life. He actually was sentenced to prison penalties several times because he was not able to pay his debt. A newspaper once wrote about Goodyear, "If you see a man wearing shoes, coat, and hat made out of caoutchouc, but without any sand in his pocket, then you have seen Charles Goodyear." We can conclude from the listing in Table 1 that for a long time mankind has used polymers from natural resources, and largely since the mid-19th century, chemists actually even modified biopolymers. However, this was still done without knowledge about their primary scale structure and about their macromolecular nature. A common belief to that time, by contrast, was that polymers are colloidal substances, that means colloidal clusters that actually compose of smaller classical molecular entities that just don't fall apart but stay clustered. This hypothetic picture was able to explain the actually large molar masses that were measured in experiments, which however people could not believe were true to that time. A reason might have been that organic chemistry during that period was very successful in assessing low molar mass molecular structures, whereas physical chemistry during that time was very successful in assessing low molar mass intermolecular forces, and so scientists might have been prone to apply both to polymer type matter too. In Table 3, you see a display of some hypothetic colloidal formulas of the polymers caoutchouc and cellulose as people believed them to be in times before 1920. You also see the modern and actual chain structures as we know them since 1920. What happened in 1920? In 1920, Hermann Staudinger, the founding father of the field of polymer science, published a groundbreaking seminal paper in which he denoted polymer materials not to be composed of colloidal clusters of small molecules, but instead of chain-like entities that are composed of a repeating sequence of units. The proof of Staudinger was made by so-called polymer analogous reactions. Three of them are shown to you in figure 11 of our script. What Staudinger did was to treat polymer materials with reagents and thereby transform them into new materials with new properties. However, what was retained in these experiments was the molar mass of these substances. Staudinger drew the right conclusion out of this observation by constituting that this can only be explained by assuming polymers to be composed of a covalently jointed chain-like sequence of monomer units. The modifying chemical reactions, such as those denoted in figure 11, modify these chains at the site. But they don't break or prolong these chains. They don't affect the primary length and therewith size and therewith mass. If the other conceptual picture were true, if polymers were formed by just loosely aggregated colloidal clusters, we could assume that modification of the building blocks of these clusters, namely the small molecules, should drastically change their interaction energies. And that should either break these clusters or make them larger. It should, however, change their size. We can get a notion about this by considering long-chain fatty acids, surfactants for example, which we know assemble to colloidal micelles. If we chemically modify them, for example, if we esterificate them, they have different interactions, and so they do no longer form micelles. The same should be expected for these hypothetical colloidal aggregates that were seen to form polymers before Staudinger's notion. As a footnote, this ground-shifting finding by Staudinger was actually first expressed really carefully by himself. In an original wording, he said, "If one is willing to imagine the formation and constitution of such high molecular compounds, one may assume that primarily a combination of unsaturated molecules has taken place, similar to the formation of four or six-membered rings, but that for some reason, potentially a steric one, the four or six-ring closure didn't happen, and now many, perhaps hundreds of molecules are jointed." The original German wording is, "Will man sich eine Vorstellung über die Bildung und Konstitution solcher hochmolekularen Stoffe machen, so kann man annehmen, dass primär eine Vereinigung von ungesättigten Molekülen eingetreten ist, ähnlich einer Bildung von vier oder sechs Ringen." dass aber aus irgendeinem eventuell sterischen Grunde der Vier- oder Sechsringschluss nicht stattfand und nun zahlreiche, eventuell hunderte von Molekülen sich zusammenlagern. This notion and conclusion actually received harsh criticism in the scientific community, for example, expressed by people who were personally close to Staudinger, such as Heinrich Wieland, who was his predecessor at the University of Freiburg, and by the way, who was a Nobel Prize laureate in 1927 for the structural characterization of bile acids, who once wrote, "Dear colleague, refrain from the imagination of large molecules. Organic molecules with a molecular weight above 5000 do not exist. Purify your products, such as the caoutchouc, and then they will crystallize and turn out to be low molecular components." The German wording is, "Lieber Herr Kollege, lassen Sie doch die Vorstellung mit den großen Molekülen. Organische Moleküle mit einem Molekulargewicht über 5000 gibt es nicht. Reinigen Sie Ihre Produkte, wie zum Beispiel den Kautschuk, dann werden diese kristallisieren und sich als niedermolekulare Stoffe erweisen." Staudinger, however, proved persistent and proved his hypothesis, and later on, he got a lot more self-confident. In the 30s, for example, he expressed, "Even though the formation of millions of compounds whose molecules are built of 100 or several hundreds of atoms is possible, this realm of low molecular organic chemistry is just a pre-stage to actual organic chemistry, namely chemistry of compounds that are of fundamental importance for processes in life. This is because the latter compounds contain molecules that are not built from some hundreds, but from thousands, ten thousands, and perhaps even millions of atoms." The German wording is, "Wenn auch die Darstellung von Millionen von Stoffen möglich ist, deren Moleküle aus 100 oder einigen 100 Atomen aufgebaut sind, so bliebe dieses Gebiet der niedermolekularen organischen Chemie trotzdem nur die Vorstufe der eigentlichen organischen Chemie, nämlich der Chemie der Stoffe, die für die Lebensprozesse von grundlegender Bedeutung sind. Denn in letzteren Verbindungen liegen Moleküle vor, die nicht aus einigen hundert, sondern aus tausenden, zehntausenden und vielleicht sogar Millionen von Atomen bestehen." Again, we remember that quote from Bruno Vollmert's book Grundriss der makromolekularen Chemie, who said that polymers are the highest level of complexity in chemistry and the lowest level of complexity in biology. A little footnote to this footnote, Staudinger had a very important co-worker during that time, who was Günther Victor Schulz, in the years of 1933 to 1941, who later on became a professor at Rostock and then in Mainz, where he re-established the university after World War II and re-established the chemistry faculty at it. This pioneering work of Schulz at the place of Mainz has certainly laid down the fundament for Mainz to become one of the most renowned places for polymer science in the world. Schulz's contributions to Staudinger's work was experimental techniques to actually carry out molecular weight or molar mass analysis, primarily through ultracentrifugation, later on also by viscometry and light scattering, and yet even later by chromatography-based separation and analysis of molecular weight distributions. Schulz also worked on the thermodynamics, kinetics, and mechanisms of polymerization processes, and is most famous for his discovery of the Schulz-Flory and the Schulz-Simm distribution of the molar mass or molecular weight in polymer samples that we have stumbled upon earlier in this lesson unit. In the following decades after Staudinger's groundbreaking experiments, the core concepts of polymer physics or physical chemistry of polymers were developed. Examples and cornerstones were the Kuhn model for polymer chain renormalization that we will get to know in our next lesson unit, the Flory theory for the coil conformation of a polymer in a good solvent, which we will get to know in chapter 3 of this class, the Rouse and Simm models for polymer dynamics, which we will get to know also in chapter 3 of our class, the Flory-Huggins mean field theory of polymer thermodynamics, which we will come across in chapter 4 of our class, and the statistical theory of rubber elasticity, which will be featured in chapter 5 of this class, which is actually on the curriculum of its second part. In the 1960s and 80s, these concepts were further developed and refined to move from the description of single chains to full assembles of chains. And that was the time when Frenchman Pierre-Gilles de Gennes discovered that methods developed for studying order phenomena in simple systems can be generalized to more complex forms of matter, such as polymers and liquid crystals also, by the way. And that led to the emergence of a whole new field, which is soft matter materials. Current research in polymer science has two main directions. The first direction is to further bridge the polymer world with a life science world, and to understand how polymers are the basis of and act in even more complex functional units and entities, which in turn are the basis for living systems. That was actually done along with the development of the, I would say, youngest field in chemistry, which is supramolecular chemistry. And supramolecular polymer science is a whole field of its own now. It actually has a quite funny twist in the myth. Whereas in the times before Staudinger's notion, polymers were recognized to be composed of units that are connected in a non-covalent fashion in the form of colloidal clusters, in supramolecular polymers, we actually do that. We connect entities by non-covalent forces, but not in an ill-defined clustering fashion, but in a well-defined chain-style fashion. The second great branch of polymer science these days is that, in retrospect, we can say that polymers have shaped mankind's last century in a very fundamental fashion. Ages and periods in mankind's history have always been classified according to the most relevant materials to that time. We think about the Stone Age, the Iron Age, and the Bronze Age. Following this scheme of classification, we can undoubtedly term the 20th century the Polymer Age. Polymers emerged into every branches of our lives in those days, and nowadays we have to get rid of the consequences of that. There is a tremendous, huge amount of polymer-based waste that is polluting our environment and negatively affecting life on our planet. And modern research, both industrial and academic, therefore has an obligation to develop techniques to address this problem and to furthermore develop new polymer materials that are as useful and functional as the existing ones, but that are degradable. Further current of research in the polymer science is to develop polymer-based materials that serve to attenuate the consequential damage of mankind's most severe challenge, which is climate change. That all requires a sound understanding of structure-property relations of polymers. And as a result, physical chemistry of polymers is a key discipline. It is not only of great academic fundamental interest, but also of outstanding actual relevance.